This is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome to Beyond Words Radio, where it's our hope and ambition to move beyond simply talking about good Christian thoughts and doctrines and sometimes arguing these things into living the life of Christ in a world of need. Now, when we go to the Bible, we find that Christ was not all caught up in argument about the government. He simply was bringing in a new kingdom, a new form of government. But the principles behind that shaped our government here in the United States of America, from which we broadcast. It's had a shape on cultures of throughout history, and there's a lot in the Bible to talk about government that honors God versus governments that turn from God and receive God's chastening hand. Which is ours right now? Do you think we're on the right track, or are we getting away from the Lord, and are we seeing some negative consequences? Well, we have with us Bill Federer. Bill is a well-known author and speaker. He's got a radio program, a TV program, and a book out called Rise of the Tyrant. And we had part one last week, and now is part two. And Bill, thank you for being with us for the second half.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Bill, as we think about the state of our country and the elections coming up, this whole concept of the rise of the tyrant probably gets a rise out of people because, you know, we wonder, where are things heading? Could it get so bad that suddenly there's some kind of martial law and so forth? Well, I know you aren't a prophet. I'm not. Not in the sense that we can predict exactly what's happening. But there are certainly trends through history, and your book brings a lot of this out. Where would you want to start us, having come off the interview last week? What's a good touch point to pick up again on the way that history brings light for today?
Well, where Jesus said, "Render unto Caesar what Caesar's, unto God's what God," when they brought him that coin, that was a dynamic moment in world history, because the kings, the pharaohs, the Caesars, the Kaisers, they claimed that they were appointed by God. They were God's enforcer, God's lieutenant, and they demanded loyalty to themselves as co-loyalty to God. And so they wanted your soul. And so the Roman emperors demanded that their image be worshipped. The Chinese emperors claimed to have a mandate from heaven. The Incan emperors claimed to be delegates of the sun god. The Egyptian pharaohs claimed to be the son of the god Osiris. And they demanded your worship. And when Jesus says, no, the secular government only has limited jurisdiction and God is above that, that was the division of what we have in America, where the government is not lord of your soul, only God is. Ever since then, this trend of the government wanting to control your beliefs, wanting to control your soul, wanting to control what you believe about men and women and marriage and everything, when life begins, the government wants your soul. And so we see this concentrating of power. You look through history, and Alexander the Great conquered. He just wanted land. He didn't make the people give up their gods. A lot of times he actually combined their pagan gods with his Greek gods. The Romans, they conquered land, and they would take that country's god and stick it in their pantheon, sort of include it with their other pagan gods. And so they didn't necessarily, you had to acknowledge Rome as superior, but they didn't make you give up your local beliefs. Not so with Islam. When Islam came onto the scene, it not only demanded land and political authority, it wanted your ideology. It wanted your, it's totalitarian. It delves into the realm of your mind. It wants your soul. And so we began to see this concentrating of power on a whole new level. But we're talking about concentrating of power. I wanted to reiterate that ancient Israel is the first nation in world history that we have record of that did not have a king. Ancient Israel, those first 400 years out of Egypt, was ruled through the law. And the law said there is no respect of persons in judgment. Rich or poor, everyone is the same, male, female, made in the image of the Creator. This is the beginning of the concept of equality on planet Earth. And it worked in ancient Israel as long as the priests taught it. When the priests stopped teaching the law, It says every man did what was right in their own eyes. Eli had his own son sleeping with women in the very tent of meeting with the Lord. They had a Levite with a graven image in the house of a guy named Micah. The tribe of Dan comes along and takes the graven image and takes the Levite. It says you can be a priest for our whole tribe. And you're sort of scratching your head thinking, what's this Levite doing with the graven image? Isn't that one of the laws? Shows that he wasn't living or teaching the law. Another story of a Levite with a concubine. The law says the Levite is to marry a virgin of his own tribe. Here he is with a woman he's not even married to. And then the house is surrounded by sodomites, and she chops her body in 12 pieces. They send it to the 12 tribes, and they kill the sodomites. And by the time you're grossed out, you read this line that says, every man does what is right in their own eyes. And why did they all do what's right in their own eyes? Because the priests had stopped teaching them what was right in the Lord's eyes. So this program, this plan of Israel ruling without a king, the rubber band snaps back. They go to Samuel the prophet, and they said, this isn't working. We want to be like the other countries. We want a king. Samuel cries, and the Lord tells him, they did not reject you. They rejected me, that I should not reign over them. So God's perfect plan for Israel was not to have a king, have everybody be equal before the law, own private property, be blessed, and the priest teaching them the system. Now, this change is best illustrated when Saul is pouting, saying, my son made a league with David. Nobody cares about poor old me. And Doeg the Edomite says, I care. I saw David get the sword of Goliath from the priests at the city of Nob and get some bread. Saul says, bring those priests here. He turns to his men, says, kill them. The men hesitate. Doeg says, I'll kill them, and he kills them all. What just happened? The people, the soldiers, had been in a republic, where a republic is the people are king, ruling through their representatives. And in Israel, every individual was accountable to God to follow the law. And so the priests were the ones teaching them the law. And when Saul says kill him, well, the law says you need two or more witnesses before you can judge somebody. And there's only one witness, Doeg the Edomite. And the law says that you get the elders of the city together, they hear the case, and then they make the decision. And they didn't have the elders of the city together. It was just Saul saying, kill him. And so they hesitated. But the guy Doeg says, king, I'm going to surrender my conscience to you. Whatever you tell me to do, I'll do it. And he goes and kills him.
Bill, before you go on, I just want to clarify for our listeners, when you say law with capital L, I believe you're talking, are you not, about the Old Testament teachings of God. In other words, in this case, it would be the laws, plural, with a small l, that are based on the character of God, that are based on the belief that people are made in God's image, they're to be valued, life is important, people are equal in God's sight, this kind of thing. So when you say law, you're talking really about God's reflection through his instruction. Is that right?
Right. And that's a very important distinction. So thank you for clarifying that. Where you have a king, the law is just the king's will, and everybody has to do it. Like the King Louis the 14th, the Sun King of France, he said, I am the state. And then he says, it is legal because I wish it. So the law is just the king's will. Well, in ancient Israel, the law was given by God, and so it was superior to the king. Now, it's a spectrum of power. One side is total government with a king. The other side is no government, which would be anarchy. No government? Unless the people have internal law, internal morals. They have this code that they're following. It's like a behavioral software program that everybody in the country is running this software. So everybody in Israel is following the law. But wait a second. Why would you follow a law? Why would you follow an internal moral? What would cause you to deny yielding to a selfish temptation? Ancient Israel had the necessary ingredient. A God who is watching everyone. He wants you to be fair. He will hold you accountable in the future. So you're about to steal something. You know you can get away with it. And then you think, God is watching me. He wants me to be fair. He's going to hold me accountable. And you're motivated to follow these internal laws. It causes something in your head called a conscience. Mm-hmm. If everybody in the country believes God is watching, he wants me to be fair, he's going to hold me accountable, everybody is motivated to follow these. And you can have complete order in society with no policemen following everyone around. It's great. Now, it only works with the God of the Bible. In Islamic Allah, God says, yeah, I'm watching you, but men can rape women and children, and, you know, I can marry children, you know, six-year-old daughters. Like, that's what Muhammad's youngest wife was, 6 years old. And you can have polygamy and so forth. Only the God of the Bible says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And had this idea of the eye for eye, tooth for a tooth. In other words, the punishment fits the crime. In Islam, you steal something, you get your hand chopped off. The punishment is a whole lot worse than the crime. Not so in Israel. The punishment fits the crime. You steal something. something, you pay back with a penalty. So ancient Israel, the rubber band snaps back, they get King Saul. But there's philosophers in history that have said, hey, in times of moral crises, there's chaos, and people let the rubber band snap back to the hands of a King Saul. Let's create crises and speed this process along. And so that's Machiavelli. So I don't know if I can fast forward for a couple thousand years.
Yeah. Okay, we will take just a quick break.
Have you ever wanted to read the entire Bible from cover to cover? Most Christians have, and you may even be among those who have attempted it. Yet only 10% of Christians have ever read the entire Bible. B90, or Bible in 90 Days, is a Bible reading program that can help you achieve this important goal for your life and for your spiritual development. By reading only 12 pages a day, you and your friends, your Bible study group, or even your entire church can read the Bible in 90 days. To find out more about B90, visit us on the web at scriptureawakening.com and click on B90, Bible in 90 Days. Read every word that God has spoken and shared with humanity. Check it out. That's B90 at scriptureawakening.com.
Welcome back to Beyond Words Radio. We're glad you're with us. Here is our guest, Bill Federer. Bill is a man who knows a lot about the history of our country and of civilizations around the world. And we're featuring his writing and his thinking around the concept of the rise of the tyrant. I just want to ask you one question for our listeners. If we're talking about two contrasting possibilities, tyranny and anarchy, and we know there are things in between, okay? So what about a monarchy in which the law of God's being honored? Is that not also a viable option? In other words, if everything gets in the hands of the king and king has absolute sway, it doesn't mean we're absolutely in trouble, does it?
In the 1700s, there was a French political writer named Montesquieu, and he was in France, and he was the most quoted writer by the founding fathers. Other than the Bible, they're quoting Montesquieu. Montesquieu divided governments in three: republics, monarchs, despots. Republic is the people are king, ruling through their servants, their public servants, their representatives. So in America, we pledge allegiance to the flag and to the republic for which it stands. So when somebody dishonors the flag, what they're saying is they don't want to be the king anymore, right? If the republic is the people, our king, ruling through their representatives. Montesquieu said republics are most often in Protestant countries of Northern Europe, and the chief need is the people having virtue. Monarchs. Montesquieu said a monarch is a king with strings attached. They have parliaments and constitutions, and they have a religion that teaches them that they are accountable to God as an ultimate judge. And monarchs, Montesquieu said, are most prevalent in Catholic countries of Europe. A religion with a visible head is most likely to want to have a government with a visible head. But now, in monarchs, the motivating force is not virtue, it's honor. Kings will honor people that obey them and promote them and make them sirs and knights and lords, and the king will dishonor and shame those that don't please him. And so Montesquieu said, virtue's nice, but it's not necessary. People will do immoral things or illegal things if the king will honor them at the end of it all. And so it exalts honor more than virtue. A despot is the third category. A despot is a king with no strings attached. He does his whims, his caprices. He kills people, takes away their wives, throws people in jail. And Montesquieu said this is most prevalent in Muslim countries, where they have their harems, their thousand wives, they chop off arms and legs, and it's almost like spirit, mind, and body, right? A virtue is you're rewarded or punished in the next life. The king honors and rewards people in this life, and it's a powerful thing. Saul Alinsky said ridicule or shame is the most powerful weapon. I mean, little kids, you know, in school, they don't want to be made fun of. And adults don't, you know, political candidates don't want to be made fun of on TV, politicians. But despots rule through physical fear and physical pleasure. So it's like a spirit, mind, and body type of division of positive and negative motivations. But an interesting person is Machiavelli. He lived 500 years ago in Italy. Italy was a bunch of city-states, little noblemen's republics, and they had armies and navies and fought. And Machiavelli thought, you know, if one prince could control all of Italy, it would stop the infighting between these city-states. So he writes a book called The Prince, where he advocates the ends justifies the means. The end of one prince controlling all of Italy is such a good end, because it'll stop this infighting, that any means necessary to get there is justified. Lie, cheat, steal. So if a prince conquers a city, the people would hate the prince. But if the prince pays criminals to kill cows and burn barns and create crisis and terror, the people will cry out for help. The prince will come in, dispatch with the very criminals he bribed in the first place. Nobody would know the better for it, and they would all praise the prince as a hero. So it's good marketing. You create the need and fill it. You go around the back of the house and set it on fire, and then you go around the front of the house and sell them a fire extinguisher. They'll pay anything for it and thank you for being there. So it's called Machiavellianism, where you create or capitalize on a crisis in order to consolidate control back into the hands of a king, right? And so the people are ruling themselves, right? It's a republic, but you have these crises. The people will beg for someone to come in, and they end up getting a king again. That inspired someone named Hegel, H-E-G-E-L. He lived in Prussia, a German province. It was conquered by Napoleon very easily. Afterwards, the king of Prussia said, we need to strengthen the state. And so Hegel said, well, the state is God walking on earth. And so he comes up with a way to concentrate power called Hegelian dialectics. It's a triangle. One corner is a thesis. The opposite corner is an antithesis, antithesis. The top corner is a synthesis. It sounds complicated, but it's not. You start off at the first corner. You create the antithesis. You create a crisis. You create a problem that's real bad. And then everybody's happy to settle for the top corner of the triangle, the synthesis. They're all happy to settle for your answer, which is half as bad. And then that answer, that synthesis, becomes the new thesis starting point. Then you create another antithesis. You create another problem that's real bad. And everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. You keep doing this over and over again until the people go from ruling themselves back to a king. After every crisis, they surrender a little more of their freedom, their independence, and so forth. Now, Karl Marx took this and applied it politically. He said, how do you create a crisis that's real bad? You have to send in agitators, agent provocateurs, provoking agents, community organizers, labor organizers. They go into a country and they find the grievances, the fault lines, the tension under the surface, and they stir up the people to riot and commit random violence and bloodshed and killing. And when the killing gets so bad, everybody begs for some strong leader to come in and restore order. And so 45 countries fell to communist dictators this way. Communism is nothing more than dictatorship. You think, really? Yeah. Every communist country has a dictator. Stalin, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, Castro, Mao Zedong. And the Communist Party members are the new royalty. They support the dictator, and they get the nice houses and the nice neighborhoods. And then the people are the peasants. Students say, well, I thought communism is everybody owns everything equally. Well, let's think a little deeper. Who decides who lives in the nice house and who lives in the dumpy house? Somebody in the government dictates those things. Well, whoever ultimately dictates those things is the dictator. Right? So communism is just dictatorship with a remake, just a different name for dictator. And so you have Karl Marx says, okay, you organize the proletariat against the bourgeois, which is the working class against the business owners. You organize the blacks against the whites, the poor against the rich, the Muslims against the Christians, the Catholics against the Protestants. You organize the Hutus against the Tutsis in the Congo and Rwanda. They really don't care who the two sides are. They really don't care what the issues are. Their goal is a destabilizing crisis that is so bad that everybody begs for some strong leader to come in and restore order. Now, it works best if the people are not Christian. Even Napoleon said, religion is what keeps the poor from murdering the rich. So if you have poor people that are Christian, they'll just forgive the grievances. They'll turn the other cheek. They'll just suffer. They're not going to get stirred up into rioting. But if you get rid of Christianity, all you have is raw human passion. And you say, you want what they have. You've been wrong. Follow me. We'll fix it. Right? Jesus had the most grievances against him. and they're mocking him, nailing him to a cross. What does he do? He says, Father, forgive them. Matter of fact, Jesus actually tied our salvation into forgiving. You remember, our Father, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those. So if you get offended and you're harboring this offense, you're not going to be forgiven. So it means you're not going to go to heaven, right? That's pretty serious. So Karl Marx applied this to politics, and they would send in people to create these crises, these grievances. And it's sort of like David Horowitz is a writer who was former communist, and he said that they would teach in communism, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. So the issue is not a Confederate flag. It's not the Star Spangled Banner. It's not some statue of Andrew Jackson. It's not. The issue is the revolution. It's a destabilizing crisis. They really don't care about the individual incident. Well, that all inspired someone named Saul Alinsky. And he was in Chicago, and he rode around with Al Capone's hitmen, Frank Nitti, and saw how all you had to do was kill a few people, smash a few windows, and the whole neighborhood would submit to the mob and pay extortion protection money. And so he applies this to politics. He says, okay, how do you push your agenda? You got to create a really bad crisis. Hillary Clinton did her senior thesis at Wellesley College on Saul Alinsky. She actually met him. Our president was a community organizer with the Saul Alinsky people in Chicago, teaching classes on how to organize and have this type of grievances and riots and so forth. And so Saul Alinsky dedicated his book, Rules for Radicals, to Lucifer, right? Ben Carson even mentioned it at the Republican National Convention. He says, here we have one candidate, you know, he's going to put on Supreme Court people that, you know, are like Anton Scalia. Another candidate follows a book dedicated to Lucifer, right? So you go to the store, buy Rules for Radicals, and it says, to the first radical who rebelled against the authority and won his own kingdom, Lucifer. And so in his book, Saul Alinsky says, the community organizer's job is to rub raw the resentments of the people of the community. The community organizer must seek out controversy rather than avoid it, for unless there is controversy, the people are not motivated enough to act. The community organizer must fan the flames of hostility to the point of overt expression. He must lead his forces into conflict. They want that conflict. And so this is the politics being played out on America. And matter of fact, it's mentioned in Proverbs. It says, six things the Lord hates, yea, seven are an abomination, a proud look, a lying tongue. The seventh is, he that soweth discord amongst the brethren. God hates that. That's an abomination. So this is the political strategy, sowing discord. So we see that we have going on in America agitators, and they want to stir up racism. They want to stir up crises. They go into cities. I lived a half an hour from Ferguson. 99% of the people rioting in Ferguson were not from Ferguson. They were all brought in. The Occupy Wall Street people, remember them?
Yeah.
And they advertised in Chicago newspapers, join more Missourians organizing for reform and empowerment. Lo and behold, even Snopes acknowledges that George Soros put $30 million into this group. And I was in St. Louis, and they would have the news cameras go up to the doors of these liberal churches where they were teaching people how to organize, and they wouldn't let the cameras in. Well, what were they planning? Riots. I mean, poor people do not get the idea of holding hands across an interstate highway. It's like that sort of doesn't cross a poor person's mind. I'm going to go stand in the middle of a highway. Somebody is organizing this. The mayor of Ferguson worked on my congressional campaign when I ran for Congress in the year 2000. And so what happens is they stir up this crisis and they accuse the local police department of racism. I was talking to Attorney General Ed Meese, former Attorney General for Ronald Reagan. He says, when they bring these accusations of racism for the local sheriff's department, Department of Justice comes in and wants to oversee the local police departments to make sure there's no racism. Well, what do? They set up camp, and they're there personally, and they take over the police department. Well, the same people went from Ferguson to Baltimore. It was a rent-a-mob. And the Democrat mayor of Baltimore orders the police to stand down. I talked to someone whose son was on the police department, and he had his hand cut up because they told him to hold the barricade but don't fire back. They do $1 billion worth of damage. Afterwards, they say that the local police department is inadequate and racist. We need to federalize them. We need to have the Department of Justice come in and give oversight. And they basically take over the sheriff's department. They do the same thing in Charlotte, same thing in cities all across America, wherever there's riots. And so what happens is the sheriff's department is an elected position by the people. It's actually the last bastion of defense that the people have. against assault from their government, so to speak. And so it's a bottom-up form of a position. The sheriff's department is bottom-up. But now we're seeing it change with the Department of Justice coming in with oversight to a top-down control of the sheriff's department, basically turning it into an arm of the president, like a standing army. It's given the president a standing army. And so the country is fundamentally transforming from a bottom-up form of government to a top-down form of government. And so what happens is the president releases lists of potential terrorists in America. Who are they? Pro-life people, homeschool people, veterans, retired police officers, everybody except Muslims. And so then they have the riots, and the Democrats do a sit-in in Congress and say the president just needs to act. He needs to take away the Second Amendment. He needs to go get the guns. And so imagine if, like in North Carolina, the street riots, and the news scroll on TV says, Governor of Carolina declares a national state of emergency. What if there's riots in cities all across America? Maybe a lot of these Muslim immigrants being brought into the country that there's no background checks being done on. And if there's simultaneous riots and killings, instead of it being a state, it could be the president declares a state of emergency. And if that happens, it suspends the elections. How are you going to vote in a downtown election office with rioting going on downtown? Oh, we'll have to suspend the election. And we could fundamentally transform ourselves back to a king, right? Instead of it being a bottom-up form of government like ancient Israel or these different republics or democracies in history, it could be a top-down form of government.
Well, Bill, thank you. Our time is running out here, but this has been very informational. I want to encourage our listeners, don't just write what he's saying off. Don't do this, because the media is not giving you the whole story. And Bill is bringing out truths that I've been hearing from inside sources that kind of know what's going on. Maybe you're already aware of these things, but we really need to have our eyes open, and we need to be in prayer before God and stand for truth, and don't just believe what we hear coming through the media. I don't think they're even aware in some level about what's happening in our country. Bill, again, thank you, and may we go with the Lord's peace, because he still reigns as king over all, doesn't he?
He does, and all this information is in a new DVD I did called Who is the King in America? And also a book called Rise of the Tyrant, and they're available on my website, AmericanMinute.com.
Thank you so much, Bill, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. And Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. Visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com, where you can download free podcasts of all Beyond Words programs.